An incision just below the ribcage gaped open. On the floor in front of his gently swinging body lay his liver. It had a few bites out of each side. The bites on one side were edged with irregular tears left by larger teeth. On the other side were those of small, orderly teeth. Brogan spun with a wail of rage and backhanded Lunetta with his fist. She crashed to the wall beside the fireplace and slid to the floor.
"This be your fault, Streganicha! This be your fault! You should have stayed here and attended a Tore!"
Brogan stood, fists at his side, glaring at the skinned body of one of his blood of the fold. If Atore wasn't dead, Brogan would have killed him himself, with his bare hands if need be, for letting that old hag escape justice. To let a baneling escape was inexcusable. A true baneling hunter would kill the evil one before he died, no matter what it took. Atore's mocking grin incensed him. Brogan struck the cold face.
"You have failed us, Itori. You are discharged with dishonor from the fold. Your name will be expunged from the roster."
Lunetta cowered against the wall, holding her bloody cheek.
"I told you that I should stay and attend him, I told you."
Brogan glowered down at her.
"Don't give me your filthy excuses, Streganicha. If you knew how much trouble the old hag was going to be, then you should have stayed."
"But I told you I should."
She wiped tears from her eyes.
"You made me come with you."
He ignored her and turned to his colonel.
"Get the horses,"
he hissed through gritted teeth. He should kill her, right now. He should slit her throat and be done with it. He was sick of her vile taint. This night it had cost him valuable information. The old woman, he was now sure, would have been a trove of information. If not for his loathsome sister, he would have had it.
"How many horses, Lord General?"
Galtero whispered. Brogan watched his sister staggering to her feet, regaining her composure as she cleaned blood from her cheek. He should kill her, this very moment.
"Three," Brogan growled.
Galtero extracted a cudgel from the interrogation tools before he glided through the door, silent as a shadow, and vanished down the hall. The guards obviously hadn't seen her, although with banelings that didn't necessarily mean anything, but it was always possible the old woman could still be around. Galtero didn't need to be told that if she were found, she was to be taken alive. Impetuous vengeance with a sword would gain no benefit. If she were found, she would be taken alive and questioned. If she were found, she would pay the price of her profanity, but she would tell all she knew first. If she were found. He looked to his sister.
"Do you sense her anywhere near?"
Lunetta shook her head. She wasn't scratching her arms, even if there weren't a couple thousand Daharan troops around the palace. With the storm raging as it was, it would be impossible to track anyone. Besides, as much as he wanted the old woman, Brogan had a quarry of greater profanity to go after. And then there was the matter of Lord Rawl. If Galtero found the old woman, fine, but if not, they couldn't spare the time for a difficult and most likely fruitless hunt. Banelings were hardly a rarity. There would always be another. The Lord General of the Blood of the Fold had more important work to see to, the Creator's work. Lunetta hobbled to Brogan's side and slipped an arm around his waist. She stroked his heaving chest.
"It be late, Tobias," she cooed intimately. "Come to bed. You have had a hard day doing the Creator's work. Let Lunetta make you feel better. You will be pleased, I promise."
He said nothing.
"Galtero had his pleasure. Let Lunetta give you yours. I will do a glamour for you," she offered. "Please, Tobias."
He considered it only a moment.
"There be no time. We must leave at once. I hope you have learned a lesson this night, Lunetta. I won't tolerate your misbehaving again."
Her head bobbed.
"Yes, my Lord General. I will try to do better. I will do better. You will see."
He led her up out of the lower levels to the room where he had talked to the witnesses. Guards stood before the door. Inside, from the long table, he picked up his trophy case and strapped it to his belt. He started for the door but turned back. The silver coin he had left on the table, the one the old woman had given him, was gone. He looked to a guard.
"I don't suppose anyone came in here tonight after I left."
"No, Lord General,"
the stiff guard replied.
"Not a soul."
Brogan grunted to himself. She had been here. She had taken back her coin so as to leave him a message. On his way out, he didn't bother to question any of the other guards. They, too, would have seen nothing. The old woman and her little familiar were gone. He put them from his mind and focused on the things that needed doing. Brogan wound his way through the corridors to the rear of the palace, where it was a short crossing of open ground to the stables. Galtero would know to gather the things they needed for a journey, and would have three of the strongest horses saddled. There were sure to be Daharans all around the palace, but with the darkness and wind-driven snow, he was sure it would be possible for him and Lunetta to make it to the stables. Brogan said nothing to the men. If he was to go after the Mother Confessor, it could only be the three of them. With the storm, three might be able to slip away, but the whole fist would not. That many men would surely be seen and confronted. There would be a battle, and they would probably all be killed. The Blood of the Fold were fierce fighters, but they were no match for the Daharans' numbers. Worse, from what he had seen, the Daharans were no strangers to battle. Better to simply leave the men here as diversion. They couldn't betray what they didn't know. Brogan cracked open the thick oak door and peered out into the night. He saw only swirling snow lit by the dim light coming from a few of the second-floor rear windows. He would have extinguished the lamps, but he needed the little light they provided in order to find the unfamiliar stables in the storm.
"Stay close to me. If we're confronted by soldiers, they will try to prevent us from leaving. We can't allow that. We must be off after the Mother Confessor."
"But, Lord General—"
"Be quiet," Brogan snapped. "If they try to stop us, you had better get us through, understand?"
"If there be many, I can only—"
"Don't test me, Lunetta. You said you would do better. I'm giving you that chance. Don't fail me again."
She pulled her pretties close.
"Yes, Lord General."
Brogan blew out the lamp just inside the hall, and then pulled Lunetta through the doorway out into the blizzard, wading with her into the drifts. Galtero would have the horses saddled by now. They had only to make it to the horses. In this snow, the Daharans wouldn't have time to see them coming, or to stop them once they were on horseback. The dark rise of the stable buildings drew closer. Out of the snow, shapes began appearing, soldiers. When they saw him, they called out to their fellows, and at the same time drew steel. Their voices didn't carry far in the howling wind, but they carried enough to collect a swarm of big men. They were all around.
"Lunetta, do something!"
She cocked an arm with fingers clawed as she began summoning a spell, but the men didn't hesitate. They ran forward with weapons raised. He flinched as an arrow zipped past his cheek. The Creator had provided a gust of wind that carried the shaft wide, sparing him. Lunetta ducked as arrows ripped past. Seeing men rushing toward him from all directions, Tobias drew his sword. He thought to make it back to the palace, but that way too was blocked. There were too many. Lunetta was so busy trying to ward off the arrows that she couldn't call a spell to protect them. She squealed in fright. Just as suddenly as the arrows had started, they stopped. Tobias heard screams carried on the wind. He snatched Lunetta's arm and sprang through the deep drifts, hoping to make the stables. Galtero would be there. Several men moved to block him. The one closest cried out as a shadow passed in front of him. The man tumbled face first into the snow. Tobias watched in confusion as the other men began swinging swords at the gusts of wind. The wind cut them down without mercy. Tobias stumbled to a halt, blinking at what he was seeing. Daharans all around him were dropping. Shrieks lifted on the howling wind. He saw snow stained red. He saw men fall in their tracks, spilling their guts. Tobias licked his lips, afraid to move lest the wind take him too. His gaze darted in every direction as he tried to make sense of what was happening, tried to see the attackers.
"Dear Creator," he called out, "spare me, I do your work."
Men were converging on the stable yard from every direction, and they were being brought down as fast as they came. Well over 100 corpses already littered the snowy field. He had never seen men slain with such speed or brutality. Tobias crouched down and was startled to realize that the twirling gusts were moving deliberately. They were alive. He began to make them out. White-caped men slipped all around him, attacking the Daharan soldiers with swift and deadly grace. Not one of the Daharans tried to flee. They all came on fiercely, but none managed to engage the enemy before they were quickly dispatched. The night fell silent but for the wind. Before there was time to run, it was over. The ground was cluttered with a jumble of still, dark shapes. Tobias turned all about, but saw none left alive. Already the snow was beginning to drift over the bodies. In another hour they would vanish under the white fury. The caped men skimmed fluidly through the snow, graceful and slithery, moving as if they were made of wind. As they came toward him, his sword slipped from his numb fingers. Tobias wanted to call out to Lunetta to strike them down with a spell, but as they came into the light, his voice failed him. They were not men. Scales, the color of the snowy night, undulated over rippling muscles. smooth skin sheathed earless, hairless, blunt heads set with beady eyes. The beasts wore only simple hide clothes beneath capes that billowed and flapped in the wind, and in each clawed hand they gripped blood-slicked three-bladed knives. They were the creatures he had seen impaled on the poles outside the confessor's palace, the creatures Lord Rawl had killed, Mriswith. Having seen them slaughter all these experienced soldiers, Tobias couldn't imagine how Lord Rawl or anyone could have bested one, much less the number he had seen. One of the creatures skulked toward him, watching with unblinking eyes. It glided to a stop not 10 feet away.
"Thief,"
the Mriswith hissed.
"What?"
Tobias stammered.
"Thief."
It slashed the air with its claw-like knife, a quick gesture graceful with murderous mastery.
"Escape."
Why would you do this? Why do you want us to escape?" The lipless mouth slit widened, mimicking a gruesome grin.
"The Dreamswalker wants you to escape. Go now, before more skinwalkers come. Go."
But, with a scaled arm, the Mriswith drew its cape against the wind, turned, and vanished into the blowing snow. Tobias peered into the night, but the wind had gone vacant and lifeless. Why would such vile creatures want to help him? Why would they kill his enemies? Why would they want him to escape? Comprehension came over him in a loving, warm rush. The Creator had sent them. Of course. How could he have been so blind? Lord Rawl had said he killed the Mriswith. Lord Rawl fought for the Keeper. If the Mriswith were evil creatures, Lord Rawl would fight on their side, not against them. The Mriswith had said the Dreamwalker sent them. The Creator came to Tobias in his dreams. That had to be it. The Creator had sent them.
"Lunetta,"
Tobias turned to her. She was cowering behind him.
"The Creator comes to me in my dreams. That was what they were trying to tell me when they said the one from my dreams had sent them. Lunetta, the Creator sent them to help protect me."
Lunetta's eyes widened.
"The Creator himself has intervened on your behalf to thwart the Keeper's plans. The Creator himself watches over you. He must have great things planned for you, Tobias."
Tobias retrieved his sword from under the snow and straightened with a smile.
"Indeed. I have kept his wishes above all else, and so he has protected me. Hurry. We must do as his messengers have told us. We must be off to do the Creator's work."
As he trudged through the snow, winding his way among the bodies, he looked up to see a dark shape suddenly leap before him, blocking his path.
"Well, well, Lord General. Going someplace?"
A menacing grin came to the face.
"Do you wish to cast a spell on me, sorceress?"
Tobias still had his sword in his hand, but he knew he wouldn't be quick enough. He flinched at the sound of a bone-jarring thunk. The one before him pitched face first into the snow at his feet. Tobias looked up to see Galtero standing with the cudgel above the unconscious figure.
"Galtero, you have earned your rank this night."
The Creator had just given him a priceless prize, showing him again that nothing was out of the reach of the pious. Thankfully, Galtero had the presence of mind to use the cudgel and not a blade. He saw blood from the blow, but he saw the breath of life, too.
"My, my, but this be turning out to be quite the good night. Lunetta, you have some work to do on behalf of the Creator before you heal this one."
Lunetta bent beside the still form, pressing her fingers into the blood-matted wavy brown hair.
"Perhaps I ought to do a healing first. Galtero be stronger than he thinks."
"That, my dear sister, would not be advisable, at least not from what I have heard. The healing can wait."
He glanced to his colonel and gestured to the stables.
"Are the horses ready?"
"Yes, Lord General, as soon as you are."
Tobias drew the knife Galtero had given him.
"We must hurry, Lunetta. The messenger told us we must escape."
He squatted down and rolled the unconscious figure over.
"And then we be off after the Mother Confessor."
Lunetta leaned close, peering at him.
"But, Lord General, I told you, the wizard's web hides her identity from us. We cannot see the strands of a web like that. We will not know her."
A grin tightened the scar at the side of Tobias Brogan's mouth.
"Oh, but I have seen the strands of the web. The Mother Confessor's name be Kaelin Amnell."
Chapter 18. As she had feared, she was a prisoner. She flipped another page over after making the appropriate entry in the ledger book. A prisoner of the highest station. A prisoner behind a paper lock, but a prisoner nevertheless. Verna yawned as she scanned the next page, checking the records of palace expenses. Each report required her approval and had to be initialed to show that the prelate herself had certified the expenses. Why it was necessary was a mystery to her, but having only held the office for a few days, she was loath to declare it a waste of her time, only to have Sister Leoma or Dulcinea or Philippa divert their eyes and explain under their breath, so as not to cause the prelate embarrassment, why it was indeed necessary, and go on in great detail to explicate the dire consequences of not doing such a simple thing that would require hardly any effort on her part, but would be of such benefit to others. She could anticipate the reaction should she declare she was not going to bother to check the tallies.
Why, prelate, if the people didn't fear that the prelate herself was concerned enough to be watching their work orders, they would be emboldened to gouge the palace. The sisters would be thought wasteful fools without an ounce of sense. And then, on the other side, if the work orders weren't paid while waiting the prelate's directive, the poor workers' families would go hungry. You wouldn't want those children to go hungry, would you? Simply because you didn't want to pay them the courtesy of approving payment for their hard work already done? Just because you don't wish to glance at the report and go to the trouble of initialing it? Would you really want them to think the prelate so callous?
Verna sighed as she skimmed the report of expenses for the stables. Hay and grain, the farrier, the tack upkeep, replacement of lost tack, repair to the stable after a stallion staved in a stall, and repair needed after several horses apparently panicked in the night, broke down a fence, and bolted off into the countryside. She was going to have a talk to the stable personnel and insist that they keep better order under their roof. She jammed the pen in the ink bottle, sighed again, and initialed the bottom of the page. As she turned the stable tallies over on top of the pile of other tallies she had already perused, initialed, and entered in the ledger, someone knocked softly at the door. She pulled another paper from the stack of reports yet to be worked, a lengthy reckoning from the butcher, and started scanning down the figures. She had had no idea how expensive it was to run the Palace of the Prophets. The soft knock came again, probably Sister Dulcinea or Phoebe wanting to bring in another stack of reports. She was not initialing as fast as they could bring them in. How did Prelate Annalena manage to get it all done? Verna hoped it wasn't Sister Leoma, come again to bring to her attention news of some calamity the prelate had caused by an unthinking action or comment. Maybe they would think her too busy and go away if she didn't answer. Along with her old friend Phoebe, Verna had named Sister Dulcinea to be one of her administrators. It only made sense to have a sister of Dulcinea's experience at hand. It also allowed Verna to keep an eye on the woman. Dulcinea herself had requested the job, citing her knowledge of palace business. Having Sister Leoma and Philippa as trusted advisers was at least useful in keeping them in sight, too. She didn't trust them. For that matter, she didn't trust any of them. She couldn't afford to. Verna had to admit, though, that they had proven themselves willing advisers who always scrupulously kept the best interest of the prelate and the palace uppermost in their advice. It vexed her that she could find no fault in their counsel. The knock came again, polite but insistent.
"Yes, what is it?"
The thick door opened enough to admit Warren's head of curly blonde hair. He grinned when he saw the scowl on her face. Verna could see Dulcinea craning her neck to see past him, checking the prelate's progress on the stacks of paper. Warren let himself the rest of the way in. He peered about in the somber room, scrutinizing the work done on it. After the losing battle her predecessor had had with the Sisters of the Dark, the office had been left in ruins. A crew of workmen had hurriedly repaired it, putting it back to order as quickly as possible, so that the new prelate wouldn't be inconvenienced for long. Verna knew the cost. She had seen the expense tally. Warren strolled up to the opposite side of the heavy walnut table.
"Good evening, Verna. You look to be hard at work. Important palace business, I presume, to be up this late."
Her lips pressed into a thin line. Before she was able to launch into a tirade, Dulcinea took the opportunity, before closing the door behind the visitor, to poke her head in.
"I've just finished ordering the day's reports, prelate. Would you like to have them now? You must be near to finished with the others."
Verna flashed a villainous grin as she crooked her finger at her aid. Sister Dulcinea flinched at the smirk. Her penetrating blue eyes swept the room, lingering on Warren before she entered, brushing back her gray hair in a submissive gesture.
"May I be of assistance, prelate?
Verna folded her hands on the table.
Why, yes, sister, you may. Your experience would be valuable in this matter.
Verna lifted a report off the pile.
I would like you to immediately go on a mission to the stables. It seems we have trouble there, and a bit of a mystery.
Sister Dulcinea brightened. Trouble, prelate?
Yes, it would seem there are some horses missing.
Sister Dulcinea leaned forward a bit, lowering her voice in that tolerant manner of hers.
If I remember the report you speak of, prelate, the horses were frightened by something in the night and bolted. They've simply not turned up yet, that's all.
I know that, sister. I would like Master Finch to explain how it is that horses that broke down his fence were able to run off and not be found.
Prelate?
Verna lifted her eyebrows in mock wonder. We live on an island, do we not? How is it that the horses are no longer on the island? No guard saw them gallop across a bridge. At least I've seen no report of it. This time of year, the fishermen are out on the river day and night eeling. Yet none saw any horses swimming to the mainland. So where are they?
Well, I'm sure they simply bolted, prelate. Perhaps,
Verna smiled indulgently.
Perhaps Master Finch sold them and just said they ran off in order to cover their loss.
Sister Dulcinea straightened.
Surely, prelate, you would not want to accuse.
Verna slapped a hand to the table and shot to her feet.
Tack is also missing. Did the tack also bolt in the night? Or did the horses decide to put it on themselves and go for a jaunt?
Sister Dulcinea blanched.
I'll see. You go down to the stables right now and tell Master Finch that if he doesn't find the palace's horses, by the time I decide to inquire of the matter again, their cost will come out of his pay and the tack out of his hide.
Sister Dulcinea bobbed a quick bow and scurried from the room. When the door banged closed, Warren chuckled.
Seems you're falling right into the job, Verna.
Don't you start with me, Warren!
The grin left his face.
Verna, calm down. It's just a couple of horses. The man will find them. It's not worth you getting yourself in a state of tears over.
Verna blinked at him. She touched her fingers to her cheek and felt that they were indeed wet. She let out a tired groan and flopped down in her chair.
I'm sorry, Warren. I don't know what's come over me. I guess I'm just tired and frustrated.
Verna, I've never seen you like this, letting a matter like some silly pieces of paper get you so worked up.
Warren, look at this. She snatched up the report. I'm a prisoner in here, approving the cost of hauling away manure. Do you have any idea how much manure those horses produce, or how much food they eat just to make all that manure?
Well, no, I guess I would have to admit that. She pulled the next report off the stack.
Butter.
Butter?
Yes, butter.
Verna scanned the report.
Seems it went rancid, and we had to buy 10 peck to replace it. I'm to consider this and determine if the dairyman has asked a fair price and is to be retained in the future.
It must be important to have these matters checked. Verna picked up the next paper.
Masons. Masons to fix the roof over the dining hall that leaks. And slate. A lightning bolt broke the slate, they say, and near to a square had to be torn off and replaced. It took 10 men 2 weeks, it says here. I'm to decide if that was timely and approved payment.
Well, if people do work, they've a right to be paid, haven't they? She rubbed a finger on the gold sunburst pattern ring.
I thought that if I ever had the power, there would be changes in the way the sisters do the Creator's work. But this is all I do, Warren. Look at reports. I've been in here day and night reading the most mundane of things until my eyes glaze over.
It must be important, Verna.
Important?
She selected another report with exaggerated reverence.
Let's see. Seems two of our young men got drunk and set fire to an inn. The fire was put out. The inn sustained quite a bit of damage. They would like the palace to reimburse them.
She set the report aside.
I'm going to have a long, loud talk with those two.
Seems the right decision, Verna. She selected another report.
And what have we here? A seamstress accounting. Dressmaking for the novices.
Verna picked up another.
Salt. 3 kinds.
But Verna. She plucked another.
And this one.
She waved the paper with mock solemnity.
Grave digging.
What?
2 grave diggers. They want to be paid for their work.
She scanned the tally.
And I might add that they think highly of their skill by the price they're asking.
Look, Verna, I think you've been cooped up in here too long and need a little fresh air. Why don't we go for a walk?
A walk? Warren, I don't have time.
Prelate, you've been sitting in here too long. You need a little activity. He canted his head while rolling his eyes in an exaggerated gesture toward the door.
How about it?
Verna glanced toward the door. If Sister Dulcinea did as she was told, then only Sister Phoebe would be in the outer office. Phoebe was her friend. She reminded herself that she could trust no one.
Well, Yes, I guess I would like a bit of a walk. Warren marched around the desk and lifted her by the arm. Oh, good then. Shall we go? Verna pulled her arm away from his grip and shot him a murderous glare. She gritted her teeth as she spoke in a sing-song voice.
Why, yes, why don't we?
At the sound of the door, Sister Phoebe hastily stood to bow.
Prelate, do you need something? Perhaps a bit of soup, some tea?
Phoebe, I've told you a dozen times now that you don't need to bow every time you lay eyes on me. Phoebe bowed again.
Yes, Prelate.
Her round face flushed red.
I'm sorry, Prelate, forgive me.
Verna gathered her patience with a sigh.
Sister Phoebe, we've known each other since we were novices. How many times were we sent to the kitchens together to scrub pots for?
Verna glanced to Warren.
Well, I can't remember for what, but the point is that we're old friends. Please, try to remember that.
Phoebe's cheeks plumped with a smile.
Of course, Verna.
She winced at calling the prelate Verna, even if it was under order. Out in the hall, Warren asked why they were sent to scrub pots.
I said I don't remember, she snapped, as she glanced back down the empty hall.
What's this about? Warren shrugged.
Just a walk.
He checked the hall himself, and then flashed her another meaningful look.
I thought that maybe the prelate would like to visit Sister Simona.
Verna missed a step. Sister Simona had been in a deranged state for weeks, something about dreams, and had been kept in a shielded room so she couldn't hurt herself, or some innocent. Warren leaned close and whispered.
I went to visit her earlier.
Why? Warren jabbed his finger up and down, pointing at the floor. The vaults. He meant the vaults. She frowned at him.
And how was poor Simona?
Warren checked the corridor to the right and left when they reached an intersection, then looked behind again.
They wouldn't let me see her, he whispered.
Outside, the rain roared in a downpour. Verna pulled her shawl over her head and dove into the deluge, dancing over puddles, trying to tiptoe across the stepping stones set in the soggy grass. Yellow light from windows flickered in the pools of standing water. The guards at the gates to the prelate's compound bowed as she and Warren trotted by, making for a covered walkway. Inside, under the low roof, she shook the water from her shawl and draped it across her shoulders as the two of them caught their breath. Warren shook rain from his robes. The walkway's arched sides were protected only by open lattice, thick with vines, but the rain wasn't driven by wind, so it was dry enough. She peered into the darkness but couldn't see anyone. It was quite a ways to the next building, a squat infirmary. Verna slumped down on a stone bench. Warren had been ready to be off, but when she sat, he did too. It was cold, and the heat of him right next to her felt good. The pungent smell of rain and wet dirt was refreshing after being inside for so long. Verna was not used to being inside so much. She liked the out-of-doors, thought the ground made a fine bed, the trees and fields a fine office. But that part of her life was over now. There was a garden just outside the prelate's office, but she hadn't had time to put her head out to see it. In the distance, the incessant drums thundered on, like the heartbeat of doom.
I used my Han, he said at last. I don't feel the presence of anyone else near. And you can feel the presence of one with subtractive magic, yes? She whispered.
He glanced up in the dark.
I never thought of that. What's this about, Warren? You think we're alone? How should I know? She snapped.
He looked around again and swallowed.
Well, I've been doing a lot of reading lately.
He pointed again toward the vaults.
I just thought we should go see Sister Simona. You already said that. You still haven't told me why. Some of the things I've been reading have been about dreams, he said cryptically.
She tried to gaze into his eyes, but she could only see the dark shape of him.
Simona has been having dreams.
His thigh was pressed against hers. He was shaking with the cold. At least she thought it was the cold. Before she realized what she was doing, she had put her arm around him and pulled his head to her shoulder.
Verna, he stammered. I feel so alone. I'm afraid to talk to anyone. I feel like everyone's watching me. I'm afraid everyone is going to ask me what I'm studying and why and under whose orders. I've only seen you once in 3 days and there's no one else I can talk to.
She patted his back.
I know, Warren. I've wanted to talk to you too. But I've been so busy. There's so much work to do. Maybe they're giving you work. To keep you occupied and out of their hair while they go about business.
Verna shook her head in the murk.
Maybe. I'm afraid too, Warren. I don't know how to be prelate. I'm afraid I'll bring the palace of the prophets to ruin if I don't do the things that need to be done. I'm afraid to say no to Leoma, Philippa, Dulcinea, and Marin. They're trying to advise me on how to be prelate, and if they really are on our side, then their advice is true,
If I don't take it, I could be making a big mistake. If the prelate makes a mistake, everyone pays for it. If they aren't on our side, well, the things they ask me to do don't seem as if they could cause any harm. How much ruin can reading reports cause? Unless it's to keep you distracted from something important. She stroked his back again before pushing away. I know. I'll try to go for more walks with you. I think the fresh air is doing me good. Warren squeezed her hand. I'm glad, Verna. He stood and straightened his dark robes. Let's go see how Simona is faring. The infirmary was one of the smaller buildings on Halsband Island. The sisters could heal many common injuries with the aid of their Han, and illnesses beyond the power of their gift usually ended all too quickly in death, so mostly the infirmary housed a few elderly and feeble of the staff who had spent their lives in their work at the Palace of the Prophets, and now had no one to care for them. It also was where the insane were confined. The gift was of limited use for sickness of the mind. Near the door, Verna set her Han into a lamp and carried it with her as they moved through the simple painted corridors toward where Warren said Simona was confined. Only a few of the rooms were occupied, their residents sending snores, wheezes, and coughs echoing through the dim halls. When they reached the end of the corridor that housed the old and feeble, they had to pass through a series of three flimsy doors, each shielded with powerful webs of varied composition. Shields, however, might be broken by those with a gift, even the insane. The fourth door was iron, with a massive bolt protected by an intricate shield designed to deflect attempts to open it from the other side with the use of magic. The more force applied, the tighter the bolt held. It had been set in place by three sisters, and so could not be broken by one on the other side. Two guards came to attention when she and Warren rounded the corner. They bowed their heads but didn't move away from the door. Warren greeted them pleasantly and motioned with a flit of his hand for them to lift the bolt. "Sorry, son, but no one is allowed in." Her fiery eyes fixed on the guard. Verna pushed Warren aside. "Is that right, son?" He nodded confidently. "And who gave those orders?" "My commander, sister. I don't know who gave the orders to him, but it had to be a sister of some authority." Scowling, she thrust the sunburst ring in front of his face. "More authority than this?" His eyes widened. "No, prelate. Of course not. Forgive me, I didn't recognize you." "How many are behind this door?" The bolt sent a clang echoing down the hall.
"Just the one sister, prelate."
"Are there any sisters attending her?"
"No, they've gone for the night."
Once on the other side and out of earshot, Warren chuckled.
"I guess you found some use for that ring at last."
Verna slowed to a puzzled stop.
"Warren, how do you suppose the ring came to be on that pedestal after the funeral?"
Warren's grin held, but barely.
"Well, let's see." The grin finally vanished. "I don't know. What do you think?"
She shook her head.
"It had a light shield around it. Not many can spin such a web. If, as you say, Prelate Annalena trusted no one but me, then who did she trust to put the ring there and spin such a web around it?"
"I can't imagine." Warren hiked his damp robes up on his shoulders.
"Could she have spun the web herself?"
Verna lifted an eyebrow.
"From her funeral pyre?"
"No, I mean, could she have spun it and then had someone else just put it there? You know, like investing a stick with a spell so that someone else can light a lamp with it. I've seen sisters do that so the staff can light the lamps without having to carry around a candle dripping hot wax on their fingers or the floor."
Verna raised the lamp higher to look into his eyes.
"Warren, that's brilliant."
He smiled. The smile faded.
"The question remains, who?"
She lowered the lamp.
"Maybe one of the staff she trusted. Someone without the gift, so she wouldn't have to worry about them being..."
She glanced back up the dark, empty hall.
"You know what I mean."
He nodded that he did as she started out.
"I'll have to look into it."
Flashes of light were coming from under the door to Sister Simona's room, silent little flickers of lightning licking out through the gap under the door. The shield sparkled when the crackles of light managed to reach it, dissipating the power with counterforces, grounding the magic with an opposite. Sister Simona was trying to break the shield. Since Sister Simona was deranged, that was to be expected. The question was, why wasn't it working? Verna recognized the shield around the door as a simple one used to keep young wizards confined when they were being mulish. Verna opened herself to her Han and stepped through the shield. Warren followed as she knocked. The flickers of light coming from under the door cut off.
"Simona, it's Verna Soventrine. You remember me, don't you, dear? May I come in?"
No answer came, so Verna turned the knob and eased the door open. She held the lamp out before herself, sending its yellowy glimmers ahead to break the darkness within. The room was empty but for a tray with a pitcher, bread and fruit, a pallet, chamber pot,
and a filthy little woman cowering in the corner.
"Leave me be, demon!" she shrieked.
"Simona, it's all right. It's only me, Verna, and my friend Warren. Don't be afraid." Simona blinked in the light as if it were the sun just risen. Verna set the lamp behind so as not to blind the woman. Simona peered up.
"Verna!"
"That's right." Simona kissed her ring finger a dozen times, gushing thanks and blessings on the Creator. She scurried across the floor on her hands and knees to snatch up the hem of Verna's dress, kissing it too over and over.
"Oh, thank you for coming,"
she scrambled to her feet.
"Hurry, we must escape."
Verna grasped the small woman's shoulders and sat her down on her sleeping pallet. With a gentle hand, she smoothed back the shock of gray hair. Her hand froze. Simona had a collar around her neck. That was why she wasn't able to break the shield. Verna had never seen a sister wearing a Radahan. She had seen hundreds of boys and young men wearing one, but never a sister. The sight of it turned her stomach. She had been taught that in the dim past, Radahan had been put around the necks of sisters who had lost their minds. Having one with the gift afflicted with insanity was like loosing lightning in a crowded market square. They had to be controlled, but still.
"Simona, you are safe. You're in the palace. Under the watchful eye of the Creator, no harm will come to you."
Simona broke into tears.
"I must flee. Please let me go. I must flee."
"Why must you flee, my dear?" The woman wiped tears from the dirt on her face.
"He comes."
"Who?"
"The one from my dreams, the dreamwalker."
"Who is this dreamwalker?" Simona shrank back.
"The keeper."
Verna paused.
"This dreamwalker is the keeper."
She nodded so hard, Verna thought her neck might come unhinged.
Sometimes he's the creator.
Warren leaned in.
"What?"
Simona flinched.
"Is it you? Are you the one?"
"I'm Warren, sister, a student, that's all." Simona touched a finger to her cracked lips.
"You should run too, then. He comes. He wants those with the gift."
"The one in your dreams?" Verna asked. Simona nodded furiously.
"What does he do in your dreams?" "Torments me. Hurts me. He..."
She kissed her ring finger frantically, beseeching the Creator's protection.
"He tells me I must forsake my oath. He tells me to do things. He's a demon. Sometimes he pretends to be the Creator, to trick me. But I know it's him. I know. He's a demon."
Verna hugged the frightened woman.
"It's just a nightmare, Simona. It's not real. Try to see that."
Simona almost shook her head right out of its skin.
"No, it's a dream, but real. He comes. We must run."
Verna smiled sympathetically.
"What makes you think that?" "Told me he did. He comes."
"Don't you see, dear? That was just in the dream, not when you're awake. It's not real."
"The dreams are real. When I'm awake, I know too."
"You're awake now. You know now, dear." Simona nodded. "How do you know when you're awake, if he isn't there in your head to tell you like when you dream?"
"I can hear his alert."
She looked from Verna's face to Warren's and back again.
"I am not crazy, I'm not. Can't you hear the drums?"
"Yes, sister, we hear the drums." Warren smiled. "But that's not your dream. It's just the dreams announcing the impending arrival of the Emperor." Simona touched a finger to her lip again.
"Emperor?"
"Yes," Warren comforted. "The Emperor of the Old World. He's coming for a visit, that's all. That's what the drums are." Her brow creased in worry.
"Emperor?"
"Yes," Warren said. "Emperor Jigang." With a wild shriek, Simona leapt into a corner. She screamed as if she were being stabbed. Her hands flailed. Verna rushed to her, trying to catch her arms and calm her.
"Simona, you're safe with us. What is it?" "That's him," she screamed. "Jigang. That's the dreamwalker's name. Let me go. Please, let me go before he comes."
Simona tore away, careening around the room, sending flashes of lightning flicking everywhere. It raked the paint off the walls like glowing claws. Verna and Warren tried to calm her, tried to catch her, tried to stop her. When Simona could find no way from the room, she began bashing her head against the wall. Simona was a small woman, but she seemed to have the strength of 10 men. In the end, and with great reluctance, Verna was forced to use the Radahan to gain control. Warren healed Simona's bleeding forehead after they had quieted her. Verna remembered a spell she had been taught to use on boys newly come to the palace when they were having nightmares from being taken from their parents, a spell to calm fears and let the frightened child sleep a dreamless sleep. Verna clasped the Radahan between her hands and sent a flow of her Han into Simona. At last, her breathing slowed. She went limp and she slept. Verna hoped it was a dreamless sleep. Shaken, Verna leaned against the door after she closed it on the dark room.
"Did you find out what you wanted to know?"
Warren swallowed.
"I'm afraid so."
That wasn't the answer Verna had expected. He didn't offer anything more.
Well? Well, I'm not so sure Sister Simona is insane. Not in the conventional sense, anyway.
He picked at the braiding on the sleeve of his robe.
I'll need to do more reading. It could be nothing. The books are complex. I'll let you know what I find.
Verna kissed her finger, but felt the still unfamiliar touch of the prelate's ring under her lips.
Dear Creator, she prayed aloud, keep this foolish young man safe, for I may snatch his head bald and then strangle him with my bare hands.
Warren rolled his eyes.
Look, Verna, prelate, she corrected.
Warren sighed and at last nodded.
I guess I should tell you, but understand that this is a very old and obscure fork. The prophecies are clogged with false forks. This is doubly tainted because of its age and its rarity. That makes it suspect, even if it weren't for the rest of it. There are crossovers and backfalls galore in tomes this old, and I can't verify them without months of work. Some of the links are occluded by triple forks. Backtracing a triple fork squares false forks on the branches, and if any of them are tripled, well, then the enigma created by the geometric progressions you encounter because of the...
Verna put a hand to his forearm to silence him.
Warren, I know all that. I understand the degrees of progression and regression as they relate to random variables and bifurcations of a triple fork.
Warren flicked his hand.
Yes, of course. I forget what a good student you were. I'm sorry, I guess I'm just rambling.
Out with it, Warren. What did Simona say that makes you think she may not be insane, in the conventional sense?
The Dreamwalker, she mentioned. In two of the oldest books, there are a few references to Dreamwalker. These books are in bad shape, hardly more than dust. But the thing that worries me is that because the books are so old, the mention of Dreamwalker might only seem rare to us because we have only two of the texts, when in fact, it might not be rare at all for back then. Most of the books from that time were lost.
How old?
Over 3,000 years.
Verna lifted an eyebrow.
From the time of the Great War.
Warren confirmed it was so.
What about the Dreamwalker?
Well, it's hard to understand. When they mention it, it's not so much a person as a weapon.
A weapon? What kind of weapon?
I don't know. The context is not exactly that of an object, either, but more of an entity, though it could be a person.
Maybe it's meant in the way that a person who is so good at something, like a blade master, that they are often described, with respect or reverence, as a weapon?
Warren lifted a finger.
That's it. A very good way to describe it, Verna. What did the book say this weapon did with this skill?
Warren sighed.
I don't know. But I do know that the Dreamwalker had something to do with the Towers of Perdition that finally cut the old and new worlds apart and kept them separated for the last 3,000 years.
You mean the Dreamwalkers built the towers?
Warren leaned closer. No. I think the towers were built to stop them.
Verna stiffened.
Richard destroyed the towers, she said aloud, not intending to.
What else?
That's all I know so far. Even what I've told you is largely conjecture. We don't know much about books from the time of the war. For all I know, it could simply be tales and not real.
Verna rolled her eyes to the door behind her.
What I saw in there looked real to me.
Warren grimaced.
Me too.
What did you mean about her not being insane in the conventional sense?
I don't think Sister Simona is having deranged dreams and imagining things. I think something real happened, and that's what made her the way we see her. The books allude to instances where this blade master of sorts slipped and left the subject unable to separate their dreams from reality, as if their mind can't fully wake from the nightmares or slip from the world around them when they sleep.
That sounds like insanity to me, not being able to distinguish what's real from what's not.
Warren turned his palm up. A flame ignited just above the flesh. What is reality? I imagined there was a flame and my dream became reality. My wakeful intellect governs what I do.
She pulled on a brown curl as she thought out loud.
Just as the veil separates the world of the living from the world of the dead, there is a barrier in our minds that separates reality from the imagination, from dreams. Through discipline and our force of will, we control what is reality for us.
She looked up suddenly.
Dear Creator, that barrier in our minds is what keeps us from using our han when we sleep. If there were no barrier, then the person would have no intellectual control of her han while they sleep.
Warren nodded.
We have control of our han. When we imagine, it can become real, but the conscious imagination is overlaid with the limitations of the intellect.
He leaned toward her, his blue eyes intense.
Sleeping imagination has virtually none of these limitations. A dreamwalker can bend reality. Those with the gift can bring it to be.
Weapon indeed, she whispered. She took Warren's arm and started down the hall. As frightening as the unknown was, it was a comfort to have at least one friend to help. Her head swirled with a confusion of doubts and questions. She was the prelate now. It was up to her to find some answers before trouble visited the palace.
Who died? Warren asked at last.
The prelate and Nathan, Verna said absently, because that was where her thoughts were.
No, they had the funeral rite. I mean, besides them.
Verna came back from her mind travels.
Besides the prelate and Nathan? No one has died in quite a while.
The lamplight danced in his blue eyes.
Then why did the palace hire the services of gravediggers?
Chapter 19. Richard swung his leg over his horse's flanks, landed on the trampled snow of the stable yard, and tossed the reins to a waiting soldier as the company of 200 soldiers galloped in behind him. He patted his footsore horse's neck while a tired Ulic and Egan dismounted right behind. The still, cold, late-day air streamed with drifting clouds of breath of man and horse alike. The silent men were frustrated and discouraged. Richard was angry. He pulled off a thickly padded glove and scratched the 4 days' growth of beard as he yawned. He was tired, dirty, and hungry, but mostly he was angry. The trackers he had taken with him were good men, General Rybush had told him, and Richard had no cause to dispute the general's word. But as good as they were not good enough. Richard was a keen tracker, too. Several times he had found telltales the others had missed, but 2 days of fierce blizzard made the job impossible, and in the end they had failed. It shouldn't have been necessary in the first place, but he had let himself be duped. His first minor challenge as a leader, and he had botched it. He should never have trusted the man. Why was he always thinking people would see the side of reason and do the right thing? Why did he always think that people had good in them, and if allowed the chance, it would come to the surface? As they slogged through the snow toward the palace, its white walls and spires mellowing to a dusky gray in the evening twilight, he asked Ulic and Egan to go find General Rybush, and to inquire about any other disasters that might have transpired while he was gone. The keep watched him from the gloom and the shadows of the mountains, the snow a dark, moody, steel-blue shawl, drawn around its granite shoulders. Richard found Mistress Sanderholt busy with her covey of workers in the din of the kitchen, and asked if it would be possible for her to find him and his two big guards something to eat, a chunk of dry bread, some leftover soup, anything. She saw that he was in no mood for conversation and offered a silent squeeze of his arm as she told him to put his feet up while she saw to it. He headed for a quiet study, not far from the kitchens, to sit for a rest while he waited for the others to return. Coming around the corner to the study doorway, Berdine stepped in front of him. She was wearing her red leather.
"And just where have you been?" she asked in an icy Mord-Sith tone.
"Chasing phantoms in the mountains. Didn't Kara and Raina tell you where I was going?"
"You did not tell me."
Her hard blue eyes didn't budge from his gaze.
"That is what counts. You will not wander off again without telling me where you are going, do you understand?"
Richard felt a chill run through his marrow. There was no mistaking who was speaking, not Berdine the woman, but Mistress Berdine, a Mord-Sith. And it was not a question, it was a threat. Richard gave himself a mental shake. He was just tired, and she had been worried about the Lord Rahl. He was imagining things. What was the matter with him? He had probably given her a fright when she woke to discover he had taken off after Brogan and his sorceress sister. She had an odd sense of humor. Maybe this was her idea of a joke. He forced a toothy grin and thought to lighten her concern.
"Berdine, you know I like you the best. I thought of nothing the whole time but your smiling blue eyes."
Richard took a step toward the door. Her agile came up in her fist. She planted its tip against the far side of the doorframe, blocking his way. He had never seen Berdine unmask such a sinister countenance.
"I asked you a question. I expect an answer. Don't make me ask again."
This time there was no excusing her tone or her actions. The Aegil was right in front of his face, and it wasn't there casually. He was seeing for the first time her true Mord-Sith persona, the personality her victims had seen, the core character of her vicious indoctrination, and he didn't like it. For an instant, he saw through the eyes of those forsaken victims she had had at the end of her Aegil. No one died an easy death as the captive of a Mord-Sith, and none but he had ever survived the ordeal. He suddenly viewed his faith in these women with regret, and felt the sting of disappointment in his trust of them. Instead of a chill, it was the heat of anger that surged through his bones this time. He realized he was about to do something he might regret and immediately took control of his temper, but he could feel the rage powering in his glare.
"Berdine,
I had to go after Brogan as soon as I found out he had escaped, if I was to have any chance to find him. I told Kara and Reyna where I was going, and at their insistence, took Ulik and Egan with me. You were asleep. I saw no need to wake you. Still, she did not move.
You were needed here. We have many trackers and soldiers. We have only one leader.
The tip of her Aegil swept around, stopping before his eyes.
Don't disappoint me again.
It took all his willpower not to reach out and break her arm. She withdrew her Aegil, along with her blistering glower, and stalked away. Inside the small, darkly paneled room, he hurled his heavy hide mantle at the wall beside the narrow fireplace. How could he be so naive? They were vipers with fangs, and he had allowed them to drape themselves around his neck. He was surrounded by strangers. No, not strangers. He knew what Mord Sith were. He knew some of the things the Daharans had done. He knew some of the things the representatives of some of the lands here had done. Yet he was foolish enough to believe they could do right if given the chance. He leaned a hand on the window frame and stared out on the darkening, mountainous landscape as he let the warmth from the low, crackling fire soak in. In the distance, the wizard's keep looked down on him. He missed Gratch. He missed Kaelin. Dear spirits, he wanted to hold her in his arms. Maybe he should give this whole thing up. He could find some place in the Heartland Woods where they would never be found. The two of them could just vanish and let the rest of the world fend for itself. Why should he care? They didn't. Zed, I need you here to help me. Richard saw light creep across the room toward him when the door opened. He looked over his shoulder to see Kara standing in the doorway. Reyna was just behind. Both wore their brown leather outfits and mischievous smiles. He was not amused.
Lord Rahl, glad to see your handsome hide back in one piece.
With a smirk, she tossed her blonde braid back over her shoulder.
Did you miss us? I hope you will not. Get out.
Her playful smile withered.
What?
He rounded on her.
I said, get out. Or did you come to threaten me with an Aegil? I don't want to look at your Mord Sith faces right now. Get out.
Kara swallowed.
We will not be far if you need us, she said in a small voice.
She looked as if he had slapped her. She turned and ushered Reyna away with her. When they had gone, Richard slumped down in a tufted leather chair, behind a small, dark, glossy table with clawfoot legs. The smoky, acrid smell from the hearth told him it was oak, a choice he would have made himself for such a cold night. He pushed the lamp to the side near the wall where hung a grouping of small paintings of country scenes. The largest was no bigger than his hand, yet each still managed to portray grand, sweeping vistas. He stared at their peaceful views, wishing life could be as simple as it looked in the idyllic paintings. He was brought out of his thoughts when Ulik and Egan appeared with General Rybish at the door. The general clapped a fist over his heart.
Lord Rahl, I'm relieved to see you've returned safely. Did you have any success?
Richard shook his head.
The men you sent with me were as good as your word, but the conditions were impossible. We managed to track them for a ways, but they went up Stentor Street into the center of the city. Once they did that, there was no way to tell which direction they took. Probably to the northeast, back to Nicobarisi. But we swept a circle of the entire city anyway in case they went another direction, and could find no trace of them. A meticulous search of all the possibilities took quite a while and allowed the storm ample time to cover their trail. The general grunted as he thought.
We questioned the ones they left behind at their palace. None knew where Brogan went.
They could be lying.
Rybish's thumb stroked the scar on the side of his face.
Take my word, they didn't know where he went.
Richard didn't want to know the details of what had been done on his behalf. From the signs at the beginning, we were able to discern that there were only three. Undoubtedly, Lord General Brogan, his sister, and that other one.
Well, if he didn't take his men, then it would appear he was simply running. You probably scared the wits out of him, and he just bolted for his life.
Richard tapped a finger to the table.
Maybe. But I wish I knew where he went, just to be sure.
The general shrugged.
Why didn't you put a tracer cloud on him, or use your magic to follow his trail? That's what Darkin Rahl did when he wanted to follow someone.
Richard knew that all too well. He knew what a tracer cloud was, from its unfavorable end. This had all started when Darkin Rahl had hooked a tracer cloud to him, so he could come and collect him at his leisure, in order to recover the Book of Counted Shadows. Zed had stood Richard up on his wizard's rock to unhook the cloud. Though he had felt the magic flowing through himself, Richard didn't know how it worked. He had also seen Zed use some of his magic dust to cover their trail to keep Darkin Rahl from following, but he didn't know how that worked either. Richard didn't really want to shake General Rybish's faith in him by admitting he didn't know the first thing about magic. He wasn't feeling very comfortable with his allies at the moment.
You can't hook a tracer cloud to someone when there's a sky full of storm clouds.
You couldn't tell which was yours in order to follow it. Lunetta, Brogan's sister, is a sorceress. She would use magic to obscure their trail.
That's a shame.
The general scratched his beard, apparently believing the bluff.
Well, magic's not my specialty. We have you for that business.
Richard changed the subject. How's everything going here? The general grinned wickedly.
There isn't a sword in the city that isn't ours. Some of them didn't like it, but once the alternatives were clearly explained, they all went along without a fight.
Well, there was that much.
The blood of the fold at the Nicobarese Palace, too? They'll be having to eat with their fingers. We didn't let them keep so much as a spoon.
Richard rubbed his eyes.
Good. You've done well, General.
What about the Mriswith? Have there been any more attacks?
Not since that first bloody night. It's been real quiet.
Why, I've even slept better than I have for weeks.
Since you took over, I've not even had one of those dreams.
Richard looked up. Dreams? What sort of dreams?
Well, the general scratched his head of rust-colored hair. That's odd. I don't really remember them now. I was having these dreams that troubled me greatly, but since you came, I haven't had them. You know how it is with dreams. After a while, they fade and just can't remember them.
I guess. This whole thing was beginning to feel like a dream, a bad dream. Richard wished that was all it was.
How many men did we lose when the Mriswith attacked?
Just shy of 300. Richard stroked his forehead as he felt his stomach lurch. I didn't think there were that many bodies. I wouldn't have thought it was that many.
Well, that includes the others.
Richard took his hand away from his face. Others?
What others?
General Rybish pointed through the window.
The ones up there, nearly 80 men on the road up by the Wizard's Keep were cut down, too.
Richard swung around and looked out the window. Only the silhouette of the keep was visible against the deep violet sky. Would the Mriswith be trying to get into the keep? Dear spirits, if they were, what could he do about it? Kalin told him that the keep was protected by powerful spells, but he didn't know if the webs could hold back creatures like the Mriswith. Why would they want to get into the keep? He told himself not to let his imagination run away with him. The Mriswith had killed soldiers and other people all over the city. Zed would be back in a few weeks and would know what to do. Weeks? No, it would likely be more than a month, maybe two. Could he wait that long? Maybe he should go have a look. But that could be foolish, too. The keep was a place of powerful magic, and he knew nothing about magic, except that it was dangerous. He would just be asking for more trouble. He had enough trouble. Still, maybe he should have a look for himself. That might be best.
Your dinner's here, Ulick said.
Richard turned back.
What?
Oh, thanks. Mistress Sanderholt had a silver tray loaded with steaming vegetable stew, black bread slathered with butter, spiced eggs, herbed rice with brown cream, lamb chops, pears with white sauce, and a mug of honeyed tea. With a friendly wink, she set down the tray.
Eat all your dinner, it will do you good, and then rest well, Richard.
The only night he had spent at the Confessor's Palace, he had slept in the council chambers in Kalin's chair.
Where?
She shrugged.
Well, you could stay in...
She paused, catching herself.
You could stay in the Mother Confessor's room. It's the finest room in the palace.
That was where he and Kalin were to have spent their wedding night.
I wouldn't feel right about that just now. Is there another bed I could use?
Mistress Sanderholt gestured with a bandaged hand. The bandages were less bulky now and cleaner.
Up that wing at the end, take the right, and there is a row of guest rooms. We have no guests right now, so you can have your pick.
Where are the Mord...
Where are Kara and her two friends sleeping? She made a wry face and pointed in the opposite direction.
I directed them to the servant quarters. They share a room there.
The farther, the better, as far as he was concerned.
That's good of you, Mistress Sanderholt. I'll take one of the guest rooms, then.
She elbowed Ulick.
What would you big boys like to eat?
What do you have?
Egan asked, with a rare show of enthusiasm. She cocked an eyebrow.
Why don't you two come to the kitchen and choose for yourselves?
She saw the glance to Richard.
It's just a short distance. You won't be far from your charge.
Richard threw the sides of his black Mriswith cape back over the arms of the chair. He waved for them to go as he took a spoonful of the vegetable stew and a swig of the tea. General Rybish clapped a fist to his heart and bid him a good night. Richard acknowledged the salute with a flourish of brown bread. Chapter 20. It was a relief to be alone at last. He was weary of people standing ready to jump should he command it. Though he had tried to put the soldiers at ease, they had been apprehensive about having him along,
seeming to fear he would strike them down with magic should they fail to find Brogan's trail. Even when they couldn't and he had told them that he understood, it didn't put them at ease. Only near the end had they relaxed a bit, but they still watched him constantly in case he should whisper an order they might miss. It unnerved Richard to be surrounded by people who held him in such awe. His mind churned with troubled thoughts as he downed the stew. Even if he wasn't half-starved, it could have tasted no better. It wasn't freshly made, but had simmered for a good long time, bestowing on it the rich melding of flavors that no ingredient but time could add. When he looked up from his mug of tea, Berdine was filling the doorway, his muscles tensed. Before he could tell her to go away, she spoke.
"Duchess Lumholtz of Kelton is here to speak with the Lord Rawl."
Richard sucked a piece of the stew from between two teeth as he locked his eyes on Berdine. "I'm not interested in seeing petitioners." Berdine's advance was halted by the table. She flicked her wavy brown braid back over her shoulder.
"You will see her."
Richard's fingertips stroked the familiar nicks and scratches on the hickory handle on his knife at his belt. "The terms of surrender are not open to discussion." Berdine planted her knuckles on the table and leaned toward him. Her ajeel, at the end of the fine chain at her wrist, rolled around her hand. Her blue eyes were cold fire.
"You will see her."
Richard could feel his face heating. "I've given my answer. You will get no other." She didn't back away.
"And I have given my word that you would see her. You will speak with her."
"The only thing I will hear from Kelton's representative is unconditional surrender."
"And that is what you shall hear."
The melodious voice came from a silhouette just beyond the doorway.
"If you will agree to hear me out, I have not come to make any threats, Lord Rawl."
In her soft, humble tone, Richard could hear the hesitancy of fear. It evoked a pang of sympathy. "Show the lady in." His glare returned to Berdine. "And then shut the door behind yourself on your way to bed." He left no doubt in his tone that it was a command, and he would brook no violation. Showing no emotion, Berdine went to the door and held her arm out in invitation. When the Duchess stepped into the warm glow of the firelight, Richard rose to his feet. Berdine cast him a blank glance and then shut the door, but he hardly noticed.
"Please, Duchess Lumholtz, come in." "Thank you for seeing me, Lord Rawl."
He stood mute a moment, gazing at her soft brown eyes, her curvaceous red lips, and her thick mane of black hair, ringlets of it framing her flawless, glowing face. Richard knew that in the Midlands, the length of a woman's hair denoted her social standing. This woman's long, luxurious hair bespoke a standing of high order. The only hair he had seen that was longer was a queen's, and above that, the Mother Confessor's. Dizzy, he drew breath and suddenly remembered his manners.
"Here, let me get you a chair."
He didn't remember the Duchess looking like this, possessing such pure, captivating elegance. But then he hadn't been standing this close. He remembered her as ostentatious, with unnecessary glitter and paint, and a dress not all simple and delicate like the one she wore now, of simple, supple, rose-colored silk flowing easily over the contours of her form, complementing her voluptuous shape, cinched just below her breasts. Richard groaned when he remembered their last encounter.
"Duchess, I'm sorry I said such cruel things to you in the council chambers. Can you ever forgive me?"
"I should have listened. You were only trying to warn me about General Brogan." At the mention of the name, he thought he saw a flash of fright in her eyes, but it was gone so quickly he wasn't sure.
"It is I, Lord Rawl, who should beg forgiveness. It was unpardonable of me to interrupt you before the assembled representatives."
Richard shook his head. "You were only trying to warn me about that man, and as it turns out, you were right. I wish I had listened to you."
"It was wrong of me to express my opinion in the manner I did."
A demure smile graced her features.
"Only the most gallant of men would try to make it seem otherwise."
Richard blushed at her calling him gallant. His heart was thumping so hard he feared she would be able to see the veins in his neck throb. For some reason, he imagined his lips brushing back the loose wisp of downy hair hanging free in front of her exquisite ear. Pulling his gaze from her face was almost painful. A small voice of warning was sounding in the back of his mind, but it was being drowned out in the roar of a river's flood of warm sensations. In one hand, he snatched the twin to his tufted chair and smutted around in front of the table, holding it out for her.
"You are most kind," the Duchess stammered. "Forgive me, please, my voice is less than steady. It's been a trying few days."
As she moved in front of the chair, her eyes tilted up to meet his again.
"And I'm just a little nervous. I've never been in the presence of such a great man as yourself, Lord Rawl."
Richard blinked, unable to leave her gaze when he thought he had tried.
"I'm just a woods guide a long way from home."
She laughed, a soft, silky sound that turned the room into a cozy, pleasant place. "You are the Seeker. You are the Master of Dahara." Her expression slipped from amusement to reverence. "You may one day rule the world." Richard reacted with a wincing shrug.
"I don't want to rule anything. It's just that..."
He thought he must sound the fool.
"Won't you sit down, please, my lady?"
Her smile returned, radiant, warm, and of such tender charm that he found himself frozen in its glow. He could feel the sweet warmth of her breath on his face. Her gaze lingered.
"Forgive me for being so forward, Lord Rall, but you must know your eyes drive women mad with longing. I'd venture you broke the heart of every woman in the council chambers. The Queen of Galia is an extremely fortunate woman."
Richard's brow furrowed.
"Who?" "The Queen of Galia, your bride-to-be. I envy her."
He turned away from her as she sat lightly at the edge of her chair. Richard pulled a deep breath, trying to clear his swimming head, and went around the table to sink into his own chair.
"Duchess, I was so sorry to hear of your husband's death."
She averted her eyes.
"Thank you, Lord Rall. But don't be troubled for me. I have little grief for the man. Don't misunderstand me. I didn't wish him harm, but..."
Richard's blood heated.
"Did he hurt you?"
When she glanced away with a self-conscious shrug, Richard had to forcibly resist the urge to take her in his arms and comfort her.
"The Duke had a vile temper."
Her graceful fingers stroked the sleek fur at the edge of her ermine robe.
"But it wasn't as bad as it must sound. I rarely had to face him. He was away most of the time, in one bed or another."
Richard's mouth dropped open.
"He would forsake you to be with other women?"
Her reluctant nod confirmed it was so.
"It was an arranged marriage," she explained. "Though he was of noble blood, for him it was a move up in station. He gained his title by marriage to mine."
"What did you gain?"
The ringlets of curls at the sides of her face swayed across her cheekbones as she glanced up.
"My father gained a ruthless son-in-law to run the family holdings, and at the same time he rid himself of a useless daughter."
Richard came halfway out of his chair.
"Don't say such a thing about yourself. If I had known, I would have seen that the Duke had a lesson."
He sank back down.
"Forgive my presumption, Duchess."
Her tongue leisurely wet the corners of her mouth.
"Had I known you when he struck me, perhaps I would have been bold enough to have sought your protection."
Struck her. Richard ached to have been there, to have been able to do something about it.
"Why didn't you leave him? Why would you endure it?"
Her gaze sought the low fire in the hearth.
"I couldn't. I'm the daughter of the Queen's brother. Divorce in such high ranks is not permitted."
She suddenly blushed with a self-conscious smile.
"But listen to me ramble on about my petty problems. Forgive me, Lord Rall. Others have a great deal more trouble in their lives than an unfaithful husband with a ready hand. I'm not an unhappy woman. I have responsibilities to my people that keep me occupied."
She lifted a slender finger, pointing.
"Could I have just a sip of tea? My throat is dry from worry, thinking you..."
The blush revisited her cheeks.
"Thinking you would chop off my head for coming to you against your orders."
Richard shot to his feet.
"I'll get you some tea that's hot."
"No, please, I don't want to inconvenience you. And just a sip is all I need, really."
Richard snatched up the mug and offered it to her. He watched her lips mold around the rim. He glanced to the tray, striving to put his mind back to business.
"What is it you wish to see me about, Duchess?"
After she had taken a sip, she set the mug down, turning the handle back around before him the way it had been. There was a hint of a red print from her lips left on the rim.
"Those responsibilities I spoke of. You see, the Queen was on her deathbed when Prince Phyron was killed, and died herself soon after. The Prince, though he had uncounted bastard offspring, was not married, and so had no issue of standing."
Richard had never seen eyes of such a soft brown.
"I'm not an expert on matters of royalty, Duchess. I'm afraid I don't follow."
"Well, what I'm trying to say is that with the Queen and her only descendant dead, Kelton is without a monarch. Being the next in the line of succession, the daughter of the Queen's deceased brother, I will succeed to Queen of Kelton. There is no one I need turn to seek direction in the matter of our surrender."
Richard struggled to keep his mind on her words and not her lips.
"You mean that you have the power to surrender Kelton?"
She nodded.
"Yes, Your Eminence."
He felt his ears redden at the title she had given him. He picked up the mug, seeking to hide as much of his coloring face as possible. Richard realized he had put his lips where hers had been when he tasted the piquant print left on the rim. He let the mug linger as he felt the smooth, honey-sweet warmth slide across his tongue.
With a shaking hand, he set the mug on the silver tray. Richard rubbed his sweaty palms on his knees.
"Duchess, you heard what I had to say. We fight for freedom. If you surrender to us, you will not be losing something, but gaining. Under our rule, for example, it will be a crime for a man to harm his wife, the same as it would be were he to harm a stranger on the street." Her smile had a hint of merry scolding to it.
"Lord Rawl, I'm not sure even you will ever have enough power to proclaim such to be law. In some places in the Midlands, it is only a token fine for a man to kill his wife, should she provoke him with any of a list of misdeeds. Freedom would only give men everywhere the same license."
Richard ran a finger around the rim of his mug.
"Harming an innocent, whoever they be, is wrong. Freedom is not a sanction for wrongdoing. People in some lands shouldn't have to suffer acts that in a neighboring land are a crime. When we are united, there will be no such injustices. All people will have the same freedoms and the same responsibilities to live by a just law.
But surely you cannot expect that by proclaiming such tolerated customs outlawed, they will stop. Morality comes from the top, such as parent to child. The first step, then, is to set down just laws and show that all of us must live by their maxims. You can never stop all wrongdoing, but if you don't punish it, then it proliferates until anarchy wears the robes of tolerance and understanding." She brushed her fingers through the delicate hollow at the base of her neck.
"Lord Rawl, the things you say fill me with a rush of hope for the future. I pray to the good spirits that you succeed."
"Then will you join with us? Will you surrender Kelton?"
Her soft brown eyes came up in supplication.
"There is a condition."
Richard swallowed.
"I have sworn no conditions. Everyone will be treated the same as I have told you. How could I vow equity if I didn't live by my word and rule?"
She wet her lips again as fear visited her eyes.
"I understand," she said in a whisper, almost lost in the quiet.
"Forgive me for thinking to selfishly gain something for myself. A man of honor such as yourself could not understand how a mere woman such as I could sink to such a level."
Richard wanted to thrust his knife into his chest for allowing fear to haunt her.
"What is your condition?"
Her gaze settled in her lap along with her nested hands.
"After your speech, my husband and I were almost home, and—"
she grimaced as she swallowed.
"We were almost safely home when we were attacked by that monster. I never even saw it coming. I was holding my husband's arm. There was a flash of steel."
A moan escaped her throat. Richard had to force himself to stay in his seat.
"My husband's insides spilled down the front of me." She gasped back a cry. "The knife that killed him put 3 slices in my sleeve as it passed."
"Duchess, I understand. There's no need to—"
She held up a trembling hand, imploring silence so she could finish. She pulled up the silken sleeve of her dress to reveal 3 slices across the flesh of her forearm. Richard recognized the 3 cuts of a Mriswith blade. He had never wished that he knew how to use his gift to heal as much as at that moment. He would have done anything to take the angry red cuts from her arm. She drew the sleeve down, seeming to read the concern on his face.
"It's nothing. A few days and it will be healed."
She tapped her chest between her breasts.
"It's what they did to me in here that will not heal. My husband was an expert swordsman, but he had no more chance than would I against those creatures. I will never forget the feel of his warm blood down the front of me. I'm embarrassed to admit that I screamed inconsolably until I could tear that dress off my body and wash the blood from my naked flesh. For fear I'd wake and think I'm still in that dress, I've since had to sleep without any bedclothes."
Richard wished she had used words that hadn't put such an explicit picture in his head. He watched the rise and fall of her silken dress. He forced himself to take a drink of tea, only to be confronted unexpectedly with her lip print. He wiped a bead of sweat from behind his ear.
"You were speaking of a condition."
"Forgive me, Lord Rawl. I wanted you to understand my fear, so you might consider my condition. I was so frightened."
She hugged her arms to herself, causing the dress to fold between her breasts as they pressed together. Richard looked down at his tray of dinner as he rubbed his fingertips on his forehead.
"I understand. The condition?"
She stiffened with courage.
"I will surrender Kelton if you will offer me your personal protection."
Richard looked up.
"What?"
"You killed those creatures out front. It's said that none but you can kill them. I'm terrified of those monsters. If I side with you, then the Order may send them after me. If you will allow me to stay here under your protection until the danger is over, then Kelton is yours."
Richard leaned forward.
"You just want to feel safe."
She nodded with a slight wince, as if she feared he would lop off her head for what she was to say next.
I must be given a room near yours, so that if I scream, you will be close enough to come to my aid.
And? She finally gathered the courage to meet his eyes.
And nothing. That's the condition.
Richard laughed. The anxiety released its constriction of his chest. You just want to be protected, much as my guards protect me. Duchess, that's not a condition. It's merely a simple favor. A perfectly reasonable and proper desire for shelter from our merciless enemies. Granted. He pointed. I'm staying in the guest rooms, off that way. They're all empty. As one who sides with us, you're an honored guest and may have your choice. You can have one right beside mine if you would feel safer. She had not even smiled before, in comparison with the radiance that came to her face now. Her hands crossed over her breasts. She let out a huge sigh, as if liberated from the greatest of dreads.
Oh, Lord Rawl, thank you.
Richard brushed his hair back from his forehead. First thing tomorrow, a delegation, escorted by our troops, will leave for Kelton. Your forces must be brought under our command.
Brought under? Yes, of course, tomorrow. They will have a personal letter from me, and the names of all our officials to be informed. Kelton is hereby a part of Dahara.
She bowed her head, her dark curls slipping across her rosy cheeks.
We are honored to be the first to join. All Kelton will fight for freedom.
Richard let out a huge sigh of his own.
Thank you, Duchess.
Or should I call you Queen Lumholtz? She sat back, her wrists draped on the arms of the chair, her hands pendant.
Neither.
One leg slid upward as she crossed it over the other.
You should call me Catherine, Lord Rawl.
Catherine, then. And please, call me Richard. Quite frankly, I'm getting tired of everyone calling me. As he stared into her eyes, he forgot what he was going to say. With a coy smile, she leaned forward, one breast slipping past the table's brink. Richard realized he was sitting on the edge of his chair again as he watched her twist a ringlet of black hair around a finger. He focused on the tray of food before himself, in an attempt to control his roving eyes.
Richard, then,
she giggled, a sound not in the least bit girlish, but both husky and womanly at the same time, and not at all ladylike. He held his breath lest he sigh out loud.
I don't know if I can get used to addressing such a great man as the master of all Dahara so intimately.
Richard smiled.
Perhaps we'll simply take practice, Catherine.
Yes,
practice,
she said in a breathy voice. She suddenly blushed.
Look at me, going on again. Those painfully handsome gray eyes of yours do make a woman forget herself. I had better leave you to your dinner before it gets cold.
Her gaze lingered on the tray between them.
It looks delicious.
Richard jumped up. Let me have some brought for you. She withdrew from the brink of the table, putting her shoulders back against the chair.
No, I couldn't. You're a busy man, and you've already been too kind.
I'm not busy. I was just having a bite before I went to bed. At least you could sit with me while I ate and perhaps share a little of it with me. There's more here than I can eat. It would just go to waste. She drew closer to him again, pressing against the table.
Well, it does look sumptuous.
And if you aren't going to eat it all, maybe just nibble then. Richard grinned. What would you like? Stew? Spiced eggs? Rice? Lamb? At the mention of lamb, she let out a throaty murmur of pleasure. Richard threaded the gold-rimmed white plate across the tray. He hadn't had any intention of eating the lamb himself. Since the gift had awakened in him, he wasn't able to eat meat, something to do with the magic at the time the gift manifested itself, or perhaps it was as the sisters had told him, all magic must be in balance. Since he was a war wizard, maybe he couldn't eat meat in order to balance the killing he sometimes had to do. Richard offered her the knife and fork. Smiling again, she shook her head and with her fingers picked up the lamb chop.
Keltans have a saying that if it's good, nothing should come between you and the experience.
Then I hope it's good, Richard heard himself say. For the first time in days, he didn't feel lonely. With her brown eyes fixed on his, she leaned forward on her elbows and took a dainty bite. Transfixed, Richard waited.
So, is it good?
In answer, her eyes rolled back in her head and her lids slid closed while she hunched her shoulders and moaned in perfect rapture. Her gaze came down, restoring the torrid connection. Her mouth enveloped the meat, and her flawless white teeth tore off a succulent chunk. Her lips were slick with it. He didn't think he had ever seen anyone chew so slowly. Richard pulled the doughy center of the bread in two, giving her the one with the most butter. With the crust, he scooped rice out of the brown cream. His hand paused before his mouth as she took the butter off in one long lick. She let out a throaty purr of approval.
I love how soft and slippery it feels against my tongue,
she explained, in a little more than a whisper. From her glistening, dangling fingers, she let the chunk of bread drop to the tray. She watched his eyes as she dragged her teeth across the bone, gnawing along its ridge. With sucking nibbles, she scoured the length clean. The piece of bread waited before Richard's mouth. Her tongue stroked across her lips.